again, we're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sant. On this program, candlelight vigils marked the death of the 2,000th soldier in Iraq, and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink speaks in Chicagoland. Stay tuned. On October 25th, the 2,000th soldier died in Iraq. The next day, there were hundreds of anti-war demonstrations across the country marking this tragic milestone. There were candlelight vigils, including this one at the corner of Cermak and Harlem near my home. Roger Hildreth of Riverside is a member of MoveOn.org and organized the vigil.
I organize this because I have trouble sleeping at night when I see things like the Iraq war going on and people dying, both Americans and Iraqis. And I just think it's high time to end the war, bring our troops home, and stop going around the world threatening to preemptively declare wars on anybody. That is not what this country is about, never was, and I hope that this is the first and last time it's ever going to happen. I do not trust the administration. Bush and company lied their way into this war as they lie today. I do not believe anything that comes out of the lips of George Bush.
Although the demonstration was hastily assembled and was competing with the White Sox in the World Series, it nevertheless attracted enough protesters to man each of the intersection's four corners. Among them stood a few of my neighbors whom I had notified about the event, and my activist daughter. Here are some of the voices of the others who were in the group.
My name is Dinah Cook, and I'm here to support the effort to bring our troops home. I think this was an illegal, immoral, and expensive war, and it's time to bring them home.
I'm David Insko from Riverside, and I'm here to get our troops home. Let people know that I don't know if they realize it, 2,000 soldiers have died as of yesterday, and we should bring them back.
Okay. What do you say to the criticism that if you bring them home now, the place is going to implode and there'll be more chaos?
Well, I don't know if we're going to police the world, and it sounds like if we don't stop the chaos there, it sounds like the same thing we heard in Vietnam in reference to, if we don't stop communism in Asia, we're going to have the domino effect and we're all scared. It's a typical scare tactics. I don't believe there's going to be chaos if we leave there. Is there bad people there? I don't know what bad people are. Bad people don't agree with their policies? Well, then maybe they're bad. But do they threaten our lives here? I don't think so. I think there was more of a reason maybe for us to be in Afghanistan. That was a direct threat. I don't think the same thing exists in Iraq.
I'm Josh Cleveland. Today, 2,000 troops died over in Iraq, so we're protesting. We want them home.
How old are you?
15.
You think about going to war yourself?
Oh,
what
no.
That would be like?
I don't want to go over there.
You think you would serve if there wasn't a war like this?
What do you mean? Like,
you think you would serve in the military if there wasn't a war like this? Or what are your beliefs about war?
I don't like war. The military never appealed to me. I wouldn't join up.
My name's Laura Cleveland, and I'm here to protest the war and our 2,000 soldiers that have died and the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. And that's Nicole.
What's your sign say?
It says honk for peace.
Have you been getting people honking?
Yeah, quite a few.
Okay. What's your name?
My name is Alexandria.
Okay. I'll stand on this side so people can see your sign. What does your sign say?
It says, "Who would Jesus bomb? Why do we kill?" And it has a verse from the Bible that says, "Love thy neighbor as thyself."
Uh-huh.
Because as we're in Iraq, we're killing. And it goes against many things that the Bible tries to tell us to do.
Uh-huh. How old are you and your sister?
My sister's 9 and I'm 11.
My name's Eric Leander.
And you're from where?
Riverside. My brother and I started a blog, a political blog, and it leans a little left. And we started a blog called NevadaThunder.com to try to educate our friends and our family members about, you know, what's going on in the world. And we don't feel that the media is really, you know, getting the truth out there. And it's important for, you know, average Joes like us to at least try to educate people and, you know, to tell them what's going on instead of, you know, what's happening on Survivor and Apprentice and all that fun stuff. So I think it's important for, you know, for us to try to get people motivated. And this is how things start, you know, this is how things begin. And so that's kind of why we're out here.
My name's Connie Scanlon, and I'm here because I'm protesting against the war, but mostly standing in silent vigil for the families of the men and women that have died and in memory of them.
Why today?
Because obviously we've just, you know, it's just been announced that we've lost the 2,000th soldier, and when it was two soldiers, it was too much. The war was wrong. We didn't belong to be there. We were led there under false pretenses. It's all political, and I don't want to lose one man or woman on something like that. We have to defend our country. I'd line up myself. That's not what this has been about, and we've lost 2,000 people. It's time to stop. Bush is not losing a night of sleep, none of the rest of those people at the top. Not a night of sleep over this, and I lose sleep every night. Those are my brothers and sisters. That's why I'm here.
That was a few of the voices of the demonstrators marking the death of the 2,000th soldier in Iraq with a silent vigil October 26th on the corner of Cermak and Harlem. Coming up, Medea Benjamin speaks in Oak Park. We're coming to you from the trenches. If you've caught sight of ladies dressed in hot pink demonstrating against the war, you've witnessed Code Pink in action. This grassroots organization began in 2002 and calls women all over the world to rise up and oppose war. Through creative demonstration from handing out pink slips to pro-war legislators and Bush administration officials, to infiltrating and holding banners at events like the Republican National Convention and President Bush's second inauguration, Code Pink gets their message out. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, spoke in Oak Park and at Loyola University in Chicago November 15th and 16th. She began her talk in Oak Park by greeting current events with cautious optimism. Medea Benjamin.
You know, there have been so many times in the last couple of years where you think, yes, this has got to be it. You know, now it's all falling apart. And then you wait a couple of weeks and say, wait, where did it go? How come it hasn't fallen apart yet? But we are seeing the unraveling now in a very different kind of way. And you can tell through lots of different indicators. First, there's the indicator of Louis Libby being indicted. First time in 130 years for a White House aide in office to be indicted. Hopefully that will be the first but not the last of the indictments. In fact, Karl Rove, you know, you don't hear about Karl Rove lately. I think they're hiding him these days because it came out in the Washington Post. They said Karl Rove is now a liability to George Bush. 59% of the American people think he should resign. And you know Bush is in trouble if his brain has become a liability. Bush has also become a liability to his own party. We saw that very clearly in California in the most recent election. Schwarzenegger and other Republicans, especially those who are coming up for re-election in 2006, are starting to try to distance themselves from the Bush agenda. And then, of course, we saw the spectacle of Bush going to Latin America. Quite remarkable to see thousands and thousands of people on the street who came out with very clear messages of saying no to the Bush administration's free trade agenda, because they had seen so clearly in Argentina that was once the poster boy for the free trade economy that had fallen apart basically as of 1995. and the people of Argentina very angry at Bush and those that have been trying to reinsert the free market agenda by trying to get the free trade agreement of the Americas passed. And it wasn't just about the free trade issue. It was also about militarization. And then we have, of course, Bush's approval ratings here at home, that every time you see a new poll coming out, they just keep going lower and lower and lower, and now is in the low 30s. And most recently, what they've also seen is that under 50% approval rating for some of George Bush's most important supporters. That includes NASCAR fans, it includes gun owners, and it includes regular churchgoers. So the tide is turning. We also see a pretty remarkable poll that wasn't advertised very much that Zogby did, that showed that the majority of people say that if Bush indeed did lie to the American people about the reasons for going to war, then he should be impeached. That's right. You obviously read the alternative media, the independent media, to even know that that poll came out. And the other things we're seeing is the infighting in the Republican Party. We're seeing it this week when they're trying to figure out how to make the budget cuts to pay for what Bush would like to do again, which is more tax cuts to the rich. In the meantime, we've got the $300 billion deficit. We've got a $200 billion tab to pay for rebuilding the Gulf Coast here, and we have the ongoing cost of the war. And so you get fiscal Republicans, fiscal conservatives who are saying, hey, wait a minute, we just can't keep doing this. That I became a Republican because I was a fiscal conservative. And we see, on the other hand, trying to come up with ways to trim the budget by taking money from Medicaid, by taking money from food stamps, by taking money from Pell Grants for college students, and some of the more liberal Republicans saying, I think this is going a little too far, especially if we're going to turn around and have another $70 billion in tax breaks to the rich. I don't think I can keep voting for this. So there's real disarray within the Republican Party right now, which is extremely positive to see. Of course, it would be nice if there were another strong party of opposition that had its act together and could be there to say, we're here as an alternative. And we haven't come that far yet. But what's interesting also to see is the change of attitude around the war. And this, we started to see the change in the polls in the summer, starting in June, was the first time that we who came out before the war and said this was a terrible mistake, we who were so maligned for our positions, who were called un-American, unpatriotic, who were spat upon, who got death threats, that it, as of June of this year, suddenly we were the majority in this country. And that turnaround only further during the summer, when we had things like Cindy Sheehan's amazing vigil in front of Crawford, Texas, and we had more and more people who started to have second thoughts about the Bush administration after Hurricane Katrina. And you add all those things together, and we now have a solid majority of people in this country who think the war was a mistake, the war is not winnable, that we are no safer at home because we're fighting over there, that say that we were misled about the reasons to going for war. We even have 6 out of 10 Americans now saying that Bush is not honest and trustworthy. You wonder about those other 40%, don't you? And we have, for the first time as of last month, majority of the American people saying whether Iraq is, quote, stable or not, we want the troops to come home as soon as possible. Now, that is a sea change. That is very important. And these politicians who have so few morals and didn't stand up with us before the war and didn't stand up with us during the war, and people like John Kerry who wouldn't even stand up with us when he was running for office, you know, are now starting to put their fingers out there and see which way the wind is blowing. And so we have today an amendment passed in the Senate onto the defense appropriation bill, where the Democrats had put forth their amendment and the Republicans didn't want to have it be a Democratic amendment, so they put forth their own amendment. And basically it was the first time ever in the Senate where you had a discussion about ending the war. Now, it was a very, very open-ended. It had no dates to it, but it said that 2006 should be the beginning of the transition to real independence in Iraq, and that with that, the Iraqi security forces should begin to take over and allow for, they won't even say the word withdrawal. That's like a dirty word, because I think withdrawal, maybe it's a male thing, somebody said they won't want to talk about withdrawal. but it also might sound a little bit like being forced to withdraw. They use the word redeployment, so that the troops would be redeployed out of Iraq and supposedly back to the United States, one hopes. And yes, there was no date on it or anything. It was just sort of a statement of intent. But that passed in the Senate today, and that passed only because of the continued pressure that folks like yourselves have done for such a long time. So while it's not nearly enough, we should take it as a positive sign, and coupled with the disarray in the Republican Party, I think it's all the more reason that we have to be out there even stronger now. Because we have to start saying to them, we don't want just a nice statement of intent. We want a date. We want to see action in terms of the troops coming home. We don't want John Kerry's plan. And John Kerry's plan is let's have 20,000 troops come home by the holidays. Well, let me tell you, the U.S. has put 20,000 more troops in just recently for the December 15th elections that are coming up. So you take 20,000 out, you're back to 160,000. We want a lot more than 20,000 troops coming home. We want all the troops to come home. So we probably all know lots of Congress people, as well as very good friends, relatives, and colleagues of ours who are still in that position of saying, yes, the war was a mistake, but now that we are there, it would be irresponsible. And we've got to be really clear, how do we answer them about that? I have been to Iraq many times, and when I go to Iraq, I don't go the way people in Congress go, which is they go to the green zone, they go to the fortified Iraq, and they never go out and talk with Iraqis. And when you go out and talk with Iraqis, it's pretty amazing how much of a consensus there is about what Iraqis want. And it's pretty simple. Iraqis want their infrastructure rebuilt. You know, since the time that we invaded that country and destroyed the electrical grid and destroyed the water system, destroyed the sewer system, is 2.5 years, it still hasn't been rebuilt. And this means that their lives are miserable on a day-to-day level. And they also are so angry when they see what has happened to our tax dollars and their oil money and the assets that we recovered from Saddam Hussein, and have how much of that money is being poured in continually to these U.S. contractors. And it is really criminal to think that so much of that money has gone to no-bid contracts, has gone to crony corporations of the Bush administration, has gone to Dick Cheney's old company that he still gets a paycheck from, Halliburton and Bechtel and the Shaw Group and Fluor and Blackwater and these security companies like Hackey that were involved in torture during interrogation, and they still get a new contract. And every time that Halliburton gets investigated for wrongdoings and actually gets fined massive amounts of money for the wrongdoings, you turn around and they get another contract. In fact, the UN just last week did an audit and came out and said that there were $200 million of Iraqi seized assets that had been given to Halliburton and that they can't account for, and asked Halliburton, wouldn't you please give the Iraqis back another $200 million of their own money? And the Iraqis get so angry when they see this. And they also know it means that, one, their infrastructure is not going to get rebuilt as long as the U.S. is there, because it's going to corporations that are really not either capable or very interested in rebuilding Iraq. And two, as long as it's in the hands of U.S. corporations, it's going to be sabotaged. So they're desperate for their infrastructure to rebuild and know it won't be rebuilt until the U.S. leaves. They're desperate for ethnic reconciliation. And it's really interesting now to see Condoleezza Rice and to see other members of the Bush administration saying to the Iraqis that they have put in power, saying to them, you have to incorporate the Sunnis now. You have to find a way to bring them in. Well, hello, it's been the U.S. policy since day one that is taken those ethnic divisions that were latent and really exacerbated them. And we see that in every single way that the U.S. has acted in getting rid of the Iraqi army and police, in using the Peshmerga from the north, the Kurds and the Shiites, to go in and destroy Sunni villages like they did in Fallujah. And, you know, it's just coming out now, the use of white phosphorus when they went into Fallujah. We saw those pictures immediately after they went into Fallujah, and it was horrifying to see. You saw pictures of people whose features were just melted. They were there fully with their clothes on, and their features, I mean, they were dead, but their features were melted, and they were there in the street. We also saw pictures of the dead bodies in the streets being eaten by dogs, because the U.S. and the Iraqi security forces wouldn't even let people come and recover the dead bodies out from the streets. And so when the U.S. came in and destroyed that entire city of Fallujah, they took the two other major ethnic groups in there to do the dirty work. And that created so much more hatred and animosity and ethnic divisions. And as we're here tonight, they're doing the same thing along the border of Syria, where they're going into those towns, which were some of them towns where Sunnis and Shiites had lived together for centuries in peace, and are now pitting the Sunnis against the Shiites. And so Iraqis are desperate for reconciliation. They don't want more ethnic violence. They don't want it to devolve into a civil war. But they think that with the U.S. there, it will continue to exacerbate the ethnic tensions. And there will be no possibility of coming together as long as they are under an occupation force that is using and pitting the ethnic groups against each other. The Iraqi women that we talked to are desperate for an end to the violence so that they can get about the business of trying to recover the losses that they have had just since the U.S. invasion, which are massive losses. And, you know, it really irks me to no end how ignorant the American people are about the Iraqi women. I was just in a plane coming over here to Chicago, sitting next to a woman who was very nosy and looking over at all of the things I was reading and everything. And she said, I had something about Iraqi women that I was reading. And she said, oh, isn't it terrible how those Iraqi women are treated by their men and how they have to go around covered up and how, you know, they have absolutely no rights. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, my God, am I going to really get into this with her now in the plane? Because it really makes me angry how little they know. Because they think Iraqi women, Afghan women, all the same, all oppressed. And it was so different in Iraq. Iraqi women had fought for and won so many gains over the last 100 years that made them the envy of women throughout the Middle East. You had in the 1950s Iraqi women that had won the rights to civil law in everything that pertained to family matters, in marriage and divorce and inheritance. They didn't have to wear a veil if they didn't want to. It was optional. And when you went around in Iraqi cities, you would see women who were involved in all aspects of Iraqi society. You'd see women who were lawyers and doctors and engineers and judges, and you'd go to the marketplace and you'd see it teeming with women, and you'd go into the university and you'd see all these young, bright women who were studying. And that has gone backwards since the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. is strengthening the hand, not of the secularists, but of the most conservative Islamists. And the women are starting to get threats that if they don't cover up, they will be targeted with a fatwa against them. The women are starting to be targeted in certain of their professions, of these conservative Islamists saying that that's not appropriate for women. With the chaos and the violence in the street has come a new wave of kidnapping, a new wave of ransoms, so that parents are afraid to let their daughters go out to the university. And of course now with a high level of unemployment since the invasion, Iraqi women are the first ones to have lost their jobs. You also have this new constitution that's very ambiguous when it comes to women's rights, because it says on the one hand that no law should undermine democracy, but it also says no law should undermine Islam. And it also says that on the Supreme Court can be either judges or religious clerics. So Iraqi women are very afraid that their rights are going to go back 100 years. And they want to get out and fight for their rights. But they can't as long as this violence continues. And they know as long as the occupation is there, they'll have no chance of ending the violence, because the very presence of the U.S. troops is fueling the armed resistance to the occupation. And this is not just from anecdotal evidence of talking to Iraqis. You know, the U.S. government doesn't want to listen to the American people who are now saying, by the vast majority, we want an end to the occupation. At least they should listen to the Iraqi people. And there have been lots of indications from the Iraqi people themselves. You can look at the time last January where they voted, and remember we saw all the pictures of them holding up their fingers with the purple ink on them. But what we didn't hear in the U.S. press is how the coalition that won the majority of votes in that election had as its number two plank that it would call for the end of foreign occupation forces. And so many people who did indeed risk their lives to go out and vote were doing that because they thought they were voting for a government that would call for an end to the occupation. Unfortunately, once that government came to power, they were then beholden to the U.S. forces to keep their grip on power. And so you see people like the President Jafari, who is now calling for a continuation of the U.S. troops, although just recently, now when he is in England this week, he started saying that the U.S. troops should, the foreign forces should have a date to leave. First, he said by the end of the of 2006, and then he said, well, maybe they should wait until 2007. But Iraqis were voting for that party, thought they were voting for a party that was going to call for an end to the occupation. There was also a poll done at the time of that of the elections that was leaked out into the press, but didn't come out in the press here in the United States, came out in other presses, especially in the Arab world, that showed that not only the majority of the Sunnis who were favored by Saddam Hussein, and that was 82% of the Sunnis, but also the majority of the Shiites, the most oppressed group, 69% of them said that they wanted the occupation forces to leave. You never heard in the U.S. media about that poll. You never heard in the U.S. media that the assembly that was elected under U.S. occupation, meaning the people who boycotted those elections didn't go into the parliament, but of those who participated in the U.S.-led elections, a third of them then went on to sign a letter saying that they thought the occupation forces should leave. You didn't hear about that. You didn't hear that there was a sovereignty committee that was formed by the National Assembly, made up, I don't think there was a Sunni in the whole committee. They were Kurds and they were Shiites. And the entire committee came out and said, to have full sovereignty in Iraq, we need to see an end to the occupation and ask for there to be a date set for the foreign troops to leave. And then you never heard about a petition that was circulated among the Shiite community that a million people signed the petition, again asking for the foreign occupation forces to end. Most recently, in August, there was a study that was commissioned by the Defense Department in England, because they wanted to know what the Iraqi people felt. And they hired an Iraqi research institute to do a poll, and that poll came out and showed overwhelmingly, it had 82% of the Iraqi people were quote, strongly opposed to the presence of the occupying troops. And only 1% of them said less than 1% said the presence of the occupation troops were making them more safe. Now, if you put all that together, don't you think that is enough of an indication to say that the Iraqis would like the foreign forces to leave? I'm asking you. Don't you think there are enough indicators out there? So here we have the American people saying they should leave, the Iraqi people saying they should leave. And now our job is to push our own government. So where do we stand at that? I mentioned that in the Senate there was the first debate that's happening there, but we also have a few new things happening. We have, for the first time, a piece of legislation that's a bipartisan piece of legislation in the House that was introduced called Homeward Bound. It's House Resolution 55. I know here in Chicago you have some progressive congresspeople and you have some less progressive congresspeople, and you've been trying very hard to get them to sign on to some of these resolutions. But this House resolution is not by any means the perfect one. Again, it doesn't have an end date for leaving, but at least it has a beginning date for leaving. And we should be pushing for all of our congresspeople to sign on to this piece of legislation, which is called Homeward Bound. And there's going to be some interesting maneuver in the House in the coming weeks, just like there was that interesting maneuver in the Senate when Harry Reid suddenly found his spine, let's say. and had the closed session of Congress and demanded that the second phase of the investigation of how the intelligence was used to lead us into this war would be carried forward. The House has now discovered some ways that they can force this Homeward Bound resolution to go on to the floor into a vote if they get 218 congresspeople to support it going directly to the floor. Then it can go out of committee, because, you know, when it's committee, then it's controlled by the Republicans and it can't even get out of committee. So we're going to see that happening in the next couple of weeks. There's also just introduced into the House in the last 2 weeks is probably the most important piece of legislation, because, you know, how do you end wars? Well, one way that you end wars is you stop the money for the war. And this is the first time now we have a piece of legislation introduced by Congressman Jim McGovern from Massachusetts that says no more money for further deployment of troops in Iraq. And that is absolutely critical, and we have to really push for others to sign on to that. So we have some moves that are happening for the first time, really, in Washington. Then what are the other ways that you stop a war? Well, another way you stop a war is you stop the soldiers from fighting the war. And that's something that is happening now as well. I know that here in Chicago, a number of people, including some of the wonderful Code Pink women, are involved in what's known as the counter-recruitment campaign. Anybody here doing that work? Can you raise your hands? Stand up. Let us acknowledge you and thank you for the work you're doing. And in the discussion period, I hope you'll talk about what you're doing and encourage others to join you, because as you told me over dinner time, you were just out in front of one of the high schools yesterday and had a really successful time talking to the students about why this is not a good option for them right now. And it is really amazing. All over the country, you find groups of young people, you find groups of parents, you find groups of raging grannies who are going out to the high schools and going out to the college campuses and becoming the recruiter's worst nightmare, because they are dogging these recruiters, trying to pass resolutions like we just did in San Francisco called College Not Combat, where we strongly ask for the recruiters to be out of our high schools. And where, like you did yesterday, people are going in front of the high schools to try to let the parents know what they don't know, that in the No Child Left Behind Act, there's this little clause that says that your children's information will be given to the military unless you sign this opt-out form. And in most places, you barely even know when the kids are going back to school that that is an option for you. So as part of this counter-recruitment campaign, people are trying to get to the parents and get them to sign out to the opt-out form, but also to create a movement to support another piece of legislation introduced by Mike Honda that says it should be the other way around, that you should have to opt in if you want your child's information to be sent to the military. But an interesting thing that's happening as part of this counter-recruitment movement and this part of young people getting involved and trying to convince other young people not to join the military is young people starting to recognize what our society has done to them, which is to make college education further and further beyond the reach of most young people today. And young people are starting to understand that in other societies, European societies, Asian and Latin America, even in Iraq, college education is free. And why isn't it here? And starting to ask these questions. And I think as we do this counter-recruitment work, encouraging young people to look for other options, we should also be encouraging them to start making some deeper demands in our society, which is college education should be a right and should be free to anybody who can't afford it in this country. Another campaign that's starting to blossom in states around this country is a campaign that's focusing on the National Guard. And when you see some of the schemes that the Democrats are starting to think about how we can gradually do this phased out, they don't say withdrawal either, they say redeployment as well. They are looking at first calling for the National Guard to come home. Well, we've got to push them on this. And it's starting to happen state by state. Because, you know, the National Guards were created to protect people in their states and particularly to protect them from natural disasters. And we saw post-Hurricane Katrina what a disaster it is if you don't have your National Guard there. And there we saw a third of the Guard, and not only the Guard, but a lot of the heavy equipment that could have been used to save people's lives was in Iraq. And that gives more impetus to these campaigns to call for the National Guard to come home. And it's being done in very different ways in very different states. For example, in Vermont, they have a very democratic system of town hall meetings where people do get together in town hall meetings and actually vote in a very democratic way. And so they have been able, in over 50 town hall meetings, to vote and have the votes overwhelmingly be for the National Guard to come home. And then they're taking that up to the governor. In other places like Massachusetts, they're collecting many tens of thousands of signatures to put it on the ballot, and it will be voted on next year in the state of Massachusetts. In California, we're doing it by bubbling up from the bottom, getting resolutions passed in city councils. We have probably about a dozen city councils already in California that have passed resolutions calling for the National Guard to come home. We're going to keep doing that, but we've also introduced it as a piece of legislation in our state assembly. And we found a really receptive response to it. So we have a piece of legislation that will be voted on when our assembly comes back in January, and we're lining up the state legislators, and we're pretty sure that we're going to be able to pass it on the statewide level. And then what you do is you create this wedge between what the people are saying and what the locally elected officials are calling for and what the governor is willing to do. And in our state, we're very anxious to see how it will be played out when you have a Republican governor, i.e. Schwarzenegger, who is trying to distance himself from a Republican president and yet will probably be afraid to go along with the resolution passed by the majority of Democrats in this state assembly. But this is the kind of thing that we have to create dilemmas for these elected officials to basically say, are you going to side with us, the people, or are you going to side with George Bush and his lies and his manipulations to get us into this unjustified, illegal, immoral war? And when George Bush is going around the world talking about implementing democracy, I think these are examples of us trying to implement democracy here at home. So I would recommend people to think here about a National Guard campaign that I think could be pretty effective. So have I talked for 2 hours yet? I can keep talking. Let me just say a few other things. One, in terms of this issue about democracy, it is quite remarkable when you look at what was the coalition that George Bush strong-armed other countries to go in with us in this invasion of Iraq. And remember, he called it the coalition of the willing, and some of us called it the coalition of the coerced. But it was 35 countries that were cobbled together to make this coalition. Some of them large countries like Britain and Italy and Spain, and some of them smaller countries like the countries of Central America. And those were basically blackmailed to go into this coalition by threats to cut off their aid money. But what we haven't seen talked about when George Bush talks about a wave of democracy, you know, he talks about a wave of democracy sweeping over the Middle East. Were that to be true, that would be wonderful. Unfortunately, as long as the U.S. continues to occupy Iraq, as long as we continue to support undemocratic governments like the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, and as long as we continue to support the government of Ariel Sharon in Israel and disregard the basic rights of the Palestinians, you won't see a wave of democracy in the Middle East. But there has been a wave of democracy in other places. And one indication of that is when you look at those 35 countries that were pulled into that coalition, because one by one in the last 2 years, their people have risen up and demanded that their governments respond to them and pull their countries out. And you see it in the small countries like Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras. And I travel a lot and I get to go to these countries and they're so proud. They said, we only had 300 troops sent there, but we fought like hell to get those 300 troops back home. And you saw it happening in Asia. I was recently in Thailand and they were telling me too how proud they were of the campaign that they organized to force their government to get out of that coalition and bring their troops home. The same thing happened in the Philippines. It also happened in places like in Europe, like the Netherlands. Even some of the closest allies of the Bush administration are going to pull their troops out at the end of the year, like Bulgaria, like Poland, like the Ukraine. And these are countries that are very dependent on the United States for a lot of their aid and trade. So it is remarkable that these countries have had this and been forced to respond to this democratic pressure. But the country, I think, where you saw it in the most spectacular way was in Spain, because that's the country where about a year ago they had a terrible terrorist attack against the trains in Madrid. And you saw the government there that lied to the people and said, this has nothing to do with the fact that we have thousands of our troops in Iraq. This is because of the separatist movement, ETA. And their press, much more open, much more democratic than the press in this country, actually said, wait a minute, that's not the case. This has nothing to do with ETA. And we know there are indications that this is because we are in Iraq. And the people came out spontaneously after that terrorist attack, hundreds of thousands of them on the streets with a very clear message. It said no to terrorism, said no to war, said no to all forms of violence. And they had an election coming up a couple of days later. And even though the government in power by the polls should have won, the people said, when there is a government in power that lies to its people, it should be held accountable. When there's a government in power that sends troops overseas against the will of the people, it should be held accountable. They voted that government out of power. The new government that came in, the first act it did was recall the troops from Spain. That is democracy in action. That's a model that we should follow. When we wrote this book, Stop the Next War Now, we were thinking that what we need in this country is a social movement. And that's the only thing that will bring these troops home, and that will, it's the only thing that will stop the next war. And sometimes when I talk to people, they'll say, well, who's the next leader? And, you know, do you think Hillary Clinton will be any better? And do you think, you know, Joe Biden might be any better? And, you know, do you think we could ever get Russ Feingold? And they're always looking for, you know, who will be the next leader that can pull us out of this morass? And we really have to look around at ourselves, because it is a social movement that's the only thing that will pull us out of this war, and the only thing that is capable of putting us in a position where we will never be fooled and manipulated again into another unjustified war like we're in now. And I see this social movement building around the country. I see the peace movement has come back and is alive and vibrant again. I see that there is a movement that came out of the disaster of the Hurricane Katrina, where people are not only doing things like rolling up our sleeves, like many of us in Code Pink who will be going down for the Thanksgiving week. There are hundreds of us going down to help the cleanup in the Ninth Ward, the one that was the hardest hit in New Orleans. But people that are getting together in the wake of New Orleans to say we have to have another way of not only reacting to disasters, but another way of investing our money so that we will take care of the infrastructure that's falling apart in our country, that we will rebuild the levees, but not only the levees, the bridges, the public transportation system, and understanding that security in this country also means that we have to invest in the things that are so important to our communities, invest in our schools, invest in our healthcare systems, invest in a public transportation system, invest in a clean and green and sustainable energy system that will get off our addiction to oil and not only stop us from being allies with dictatorships overseas, but will get serious about the real threats to our civilization, such as the threat of global warming. I think we have more and more people that are joining us in that kind of movement right now. So I think it's a time for us to take heart. It's a time for us to recognize that the Bush agenda is falling apart. You don't hear him talk about the privatization of Social Security anymore. You don't hear him talking anymore about repealing the estate tax anymore. And I don't think they're going to be able to pass this new $70 billion tax breaks to the rich again. So I think we're at a time where our movement is building. And I think we're also at a time where we are part of a global movement. And I know any time that I start to feel depressed, any time that I start to feel that, you know, we're small, that there's such power, look, they're going to have the Supreme Court, and they're going to have all the branches of government, and we can't believe in our machines for voting anymore, and, you know, oh, ain't it all awful? I think, no, it's not all awful. We have a movement in this country, and we are part of a much, much bigger global movement. And the other thing is to understand that we're part of history and that empires do not last. Empires come and go because empires eat away not only at the people who are the victims of those empires overseas, but they create their own victims here at home. And that's what this empire is doing to us. But empires get corroded and overthrown both by those from the outside who are fighting them and by those from the inside. And I want to end with an experience I had recently by going to Venezuela. And I was in Venezuela just in October last month on October 12th, which is still called Columbus Day. Is that what it's called here at home? So since Hugo Chavez came into power, it's been called the Day of the Indigenous Peoples. And we happened to be there in a delegation on that day and got invited by Hugo Chavez to go with him out to the countryside to celebrate the Indigenous Peoples Day. And it was just an amazing experience. We went out in one small plane to another small plane into the helicopter and then out into these remote areas that was still land where Indigenous people were living. And he had called in the Indigenous people from all over Venezuela to celebrate that day. And well, George Bush says that Hugo Chavez is a dictator. It was actually nice to see what a president can do in that he preempted all of the TV stations that day. So it was not only the one state-owned TV station, but all of the private stations were preempted for an hour so that all the Venezuelan people could see the celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day. And it was a beautiful celebration because one by one, the Indigenous communities came up and received the land titles to their land. And so the first time in over 500 years where they had been given recognition to the land that so rightly belonged to them, and where their president, who himself has Indigenous blood and was so proud of that Indigenous blood, was talking not only about the importance of trying to right the wrongs of the last 500 years, but looking forward of how important it is to get the Indigenous voices of Latin America out there. And he's then started railing on the Bush administration and the empire, and, you know, he can go on and on about that for a long time. And then he stopped and he saw us in the audience there, and he said, but I want to recognize the group of people from the United States who are here today. And I want people to understand that when we talk about our problems with the empire, we're not talking about the people who live within that empire, because we have to recognize that in the United States is the people of Martin Luther King. And we have to recognize that there are so many people within the United States who are victims of that empire, who are victims because you can't be both a democracy and an empire. And so he said, you know, let us recognize that as we are fighting from the outside to rid ourselves of the yoke of empire, we're doing it in solidarity with the people on the inside who are trying to build real democracy within their own country and liberate the people of Martin Luther King. So let me end on those words of Hugo Chavez and on the idea of us liberating ourselves and becoming once more the people of Martin Luther King and having a mutual liberation with the people in the rest of the world. Thank you.
You're listening to Medea Benjamin of Code Pink speaking at Unity Temple in Oak Park on Tuesday, November 15th. We have time for just a bit of the discussion that followed her talk.
December 13th is going to mark the 1,000th day of this war. So we felt it was important that we do something to mark this date in December. So a number of us will be going to legislators' offices and saying, we don't want an exit strategy, we want out now. 1,000 days, 2,000 lives, $218 billion spent, too much, cut and run. Let's stop this madness.
I would just be careful with the cut and run part. Really, we don't want to say cut and run because, one, it's not a nice term, and two, it acts like we have no responsibility to the Iraqis, and we do have big responsibility to the Iraqis. So let me just say what those responsibilities are so we're very clear about that. The biggest responsibility is financial compensation. We do have to pay for the rebuilding of Iraq, but not by giving the contracts to U.S. companies, by allowing the Iraqis to rebuild their own country. But at a time when the U.S. people are saying, we can't afford the war, we need the money here at home, we have to say clearly, but we do have to pay Iraq to rebuild the infrastructure that we destroyed. So I would just add that piece when you talk about what we do owe.
Yeah, what I want to know is, why is the Bush administration still fighting this war when it's so plain that so many people are against it, not only from our own country, but from all other countries around the world?
Good question.
think a lot of people are asking it. And I would answer it in a couple of ways. I mean, one, certainly if the main export of Iraq was broccoli, we wouldn't have invaded it. There is the second largest world's reserves of oil, and that's a major reason for going in, but it's not the only reason to go in. And in terms of the oil, it's also not just to have access to Iraqi oil, because we had access to Iraqi oil. It's to have control of Iraqi oil, which means that we control who else can get Iraqi oil, if it's the Japanese or the Chinese or the Europeans. It's part of the U.S. wanting control, as we are losing control economically to places like China. The other is Israel. Iraq was very hostile to Israel. The U.S. has been doing everything it can, short of trying to support a truly viable Palestinian state, of trying to change regimes in the Middle East to make them more, quote, friendly to Israel. Of course, it didn't turn out that way in the case of Iraq, because they have a government that is now much more friendly to Iran than it probably will be to either Israel or the United States. And I think the other is a larger economic question, that the U.S. government wanted to impose this free market system on Iraq. I think probably thought that it would then be able to have the domino effect and impose that same free market system on other countries in the Middle East. And you see that that was one of the key goals, because during the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the U.S. Authority in Iraq before they had the Iraqi elections, the U.S. imposed illegally against the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions, because they say that an occupying force cannot change the laws of the country that it occupies unless it's absolutely essential. And the U.S., while we occupied that country, put into place 100 orders to basically change the entire economic structure of Iraq. And that included imposing things that they could never impose here in the United States, like a flat tax, like lifting all tariffs on foreign goods so that foreign goods could then flood into Iraq and destroyed a lot of Iraqi businesses. It included changing the law that said only 49% of Iraqi companies could be owned by foreign companies, and now made it 100%. And even imposed one order, Order 1333, that said that companies that invested in the oil industry in Iraq would not be liable to any lawsuits. And also 100% repatriation of profits. An immediate repatriation of profits. When these orders were imposed, the Economist magazine called it a capitalist dream. This is the idea that they had to open the Iraqi borders, to sell off the 200 Iraqi state-owned corporations, and to have foreign corporations, and of course basically U.S. corporations, be able to snatch those up. That was one of the goals. Again, that hasn't turned out that way, but I think the U.S., the Bush administration, is still hoping that they will be able to keep those laws in place. And so far, the government that we have helped place in power has not nullified those laws, but they should be nullified.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, Women for Peace, speaking in Oak Park on November 15th. Benjamin has co-authored a new book, titled Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism. It's a compilation of thoughts and deeds of those working in the anti-war movement. It also serves as an activist's handbook, brimming with ideas on how to play a part in the movement yourself. For more information about the book and about the Chicago chapter of Code Pink, email codepinkchicago@yahoo.com. From the Trenches was produced by the Chicago Independent Media Center at the studios of Loyola University. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, or find news and information from Chicago and around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Many thanks to WLUW for their continued support. Listen again on the last Monday in December for another report from the Trenches.